Welcome to the B-side. Once again, glad you are with us. I'm loving our theme music. I love that we have an intro song. Steve worked hard at finding that. Probably not that hard, but it's fun that we don't have to waste our time searching for an intro song every week. Now we got one that is hilarious and strange and has the title of our podcast in it. So welcome. Tyler here, obviously, in case you didn't know, I'm kind of a big deal. And I'm not a big deal at all. But join with me, as always, Steve.
Hey.
And, I got a few things we want to get into today. The first, so you might remember a couple of weeks ago, we did a kind of a conversation on a blog. We've been doing these 9-thing, 5-thing, 6-thing blogs we've been finding. And we did 8 things, I think it was, or 9 things to not say to your pastor right before he preaches. And got a lot of feedback on it.
Yeah.
That people enjoyed it.
I've had so many people be like, oh, Steve, I don't want to bug you because it's before the... I had someone talk, they had a question they wanted to ask me. And it was like an hour before the service. And I'm like, it's fine. Let's talk. What's going on? Anyway.
Yeah, it's so that one was pretty popular, and then
more fun than anything. Yeah.
Yeah, and so I found another one that was just, I think it was put up today, and it was 10 things not to say to your pastor right after they preach. So we had before, like how not to throw them, and then after, how not to maybe want to make them commit suicide or something. But I kind of was super surprised at how awful some of the things...
Are these real?
...that were said were, like... Now, warranted, we don't have... We're not inflicting tone or relationship. We're reading them from, like... I'm reading them almost like every person was really mad. I've maybe had one or two of these in my career, and it was not even... Like, it was never said in a mean spirit. It's just sometimes if you were maybe a little sensitive, you took it, you could get yourself pretty offended.
All right, let's hear them.
But okay, here are the 10. I'm going to be late for lunch because you preach so long. Because that's most important. You must not have had much time to prepare that sermon. That one is like, that is like brutal. Which, especially if it's true. that's like caught with your... hands in the cookie jar kind of thing. My former pastor preached a much better sermon from that text. Well, that's helpful. Number 4, I wish so-and-so would have heard that sermon.
I've heard that.
I've heard that. And
well, it's kind of frustrating because when people are thinking that way, instead of actually receiving God's word for them,
right?
They're going, you know who should hear this?
Yeah.
My Aunt Susie, because she's messed up.
And like, it's like the Bible becomes a weapon for their...
Yeah, and so it's more like, yeah, that would be great if they would have heard it, but I wish you had heard God's word, too.
Yeah. Number 5, you act like you weren't feeling well while you preached. Like, none of these are all, like, what I call, like, the kind of insults my mom gives me. Like, you know, your mom might make an observation about you, and she's just being sweet, loving mom, but she's kind of... If it was in any other context, it would be really offensive. That's kind of how I see these things. People are trying to be mean, but if you read them out of context, they just sound brutal. I'm sorry. I've had this one. I'm sorry I fell asleep while you were preaching. Your voice just puts me to sleep. Now, one of my funniest stories, I'll tell you this. This is really quick on this one. I preached frequently in a church with a pretty large seniors population, so it was common to have them fall asleep in the sermon. And I'm talking like 80 plus, like some older folks. And I remember I was doing a sermon and I was talking about God's glory and like how if we haven't experienced the reality of God's presence just by looking at things around us, we need to wake up. And I clapped my hands together and I just remember seeing an old guy, like he was like this, and all of a sudden it scared him awake and it was like, ooh! He jumped up in his seat and like it was all I could do to hold it together. I was like at the apex of my point in the sermon and I got excited and I was like, wake up! And this guy, like, woke up, and I was like, oh, man, that literally happened. It was pretty awesome. Okay, number 7. You like that? Is that not a great story? Your subject or verb agreement was incorrect 3 times in your sermon. I have had my grammar corrected, but sometimes it's – some people just have, like, that's their nuance. They just kind of have, like, a little – axe to grind when it comes to grammar. I'm not a grammar.
Sometimes you start a sentence and you don't know how you're going to end it.
Right.
And you kind of, oh, right.
And you know what? And quite honestly, sometimes you have people in the congregation that are very experienced public speakers.
Different style.
And they, yeah, and they, or a different style. And they think often, and often assume or suggest that preaching and public speaking completely continuous road, that they work into together. Yeah. Whereas, so, you know, in a public speech, you may not use colloquialisms, you may not use slang, you may not use casual speak, so to speak. Whereas in a sermon, depending on who you're preaching to and the style,
context,
you may find it's appropriate. And so sometimes people have those axes to grind. I had a lady in my last church who would like to complain to my senior pastor when I preached because I used colloquialisms or slang, for lack of a better term, or improper grammar, but she was an English teacher and it was just her thing, right?
It like, just stuck out to her. It just stuck out to her, right? It just goes,
oh. Yeah, and she was completely sweet and graceful about it. It wasn't like she was coming after me.
Yeah. It'd be, for people like that, it would be really hard to not.
Right.
To not notice.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, we all have those things that we tend to notice. I wish, number eight, I wish you wouldn't preach from the Old Testament. Have you heard that one recently? We've been preaching from Ezekiel.
I've never had someone say it directly, but I think sometimes people are thinking it.
Yeah.
I've never, no.
You know what, and I think a lot of it is it's accessibility. I think sometimes we find the New Testament.
Yeah.
Like, I know if I'm
more gonna relatable, more.
Just open my Bible and do some reading, chances are I'm going to read something that in the New Testament.
Mm-hmm.
Because I feel like I can almost flip anywhere in the New Testament and read it, and it's approachable. Whereas, like, you turn to, like,
Old Testament's
Amos
more
or Obadiah, and you're like, what is going on?
It's just more work. It's like a treasure hunt, and it's harder to get to the treasure.
Yeah. Number nine, let me tell you what you missed in your sermon. That one, I don't know that you can do that one nicely. Like,
that's what I say to you when you
that one's fair. Yeah, that's true. Number 10, are we ever going to be done with this sermon series? I'm sure you've got that one in the church before. And I would say maybe justifiably.
I haven't had it like that explicit. I had someone ask me just last week, how long are we going to be in Ezekiel?
Yeah.
And it was really like, I'm not feeling this.
Yeah.
And I think,
a couple more weeks.
Fair enough.
What, three? No, six more weeks?
Four more weeks.
It's going to feel like six, but it was only three. I'm just kidding.
Next week.
We're in the good part, though. We're in
chapter
the good,
36.
Like,
a little overview. Chapter 36. You know, the question that the video really focused on, this divine crisis of what's God going to do?
Yeah.
It gets resolved in chapter 36 when he gives them a new heart and a new spirit. It's an amazing passage, chapter 36. Chapter 37 then, the following week, Valley of Dry Bones, resurrection, new life. People love the image, but what does it mean? And then we're doing chapter 38 and 39, which is really weird and cool and bizarre where this... where it's like God judges all his enemies and defeats them, and gives them this incredible peace. It's a really cool passage. It's kind of bizarre. It's like a cartoon almost. And then the big vision of the temple vision, chapter 40 to 48, we're going to cover in 1 week. So four more to go. And then it's Easter, and we're launching a really cool new series, which I've been pumped about. We're going to, should I spoil the beans?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, we're starting a series in Acts, starting on Easter Sunday. We're going to go through the first half of the book of Acts over the summer. We did Luke a few years ago before you were here. Went through the whole book of Luke. Took 73 weeks.
I'm sure no one thought,
when is this going to end?
The quick answer is always, for this church, when the book ends. Yeah. So if you're starting Luke. And
so we did the whole thing of Luke. Took a year and a half. And I was like, well, you got to do Acts because the story's not done yet, right? Like you haven't...
Right.
And I was pumped about doing Acts, and I kind of talked to a few people about it. Yeah, I'm thinking of doing Acts next. And I kept getting, like, these looks of horror. Like, really? Like, oh, boy.
So you did, like, a Philippians series?
Like, I can't remember what we did after, but I was like, maybe I need to take a break for a couple years. Because it was like, it's like finding out we're almost done Luke, and then we get to do something new. And you find out, no, we're only halfway. There's a sequel.
Yeah.
So we're getting to Acts this summer, which I'm really excited about. I was I was away for a couple days, and I read through the whole book of Acts in like one sitting. And
oh, nice.
It was an amazing book. It's going to be really good.
I've done that for a series I preached as a part of in Matthew and the one we did in Romans. I remember I was away on holidays. It was actually before I started. We were doing Romans. We started that January.
Yeah.
And so my wife and I were away, and I just remember on the flight home from California, I just read through the whole book of Romans in one sitting. And then, of course, like read through it again when you study and preach and stuff.
Yeah.
But it's interesting, like, when you're preparing, like, because I'm sure I'll preach in that Acts series at some point. I'll do the same thing, sit down and just read through Acts in one sitting. It's a really cool, it gets you jacked to, like, preach, because you get, like, you're not just reading, like, oh, here's Paul doing this or Peter doing that. Like, it's, you get the whole picture, you get the story, and it's, like, you get captivated.
You get the big picture. I would encourage, like, for our listeners, in 1 month's time, we're on Easter Sunday, we're starting Acts, and we're going to go through Acts 1 to 12 between now and September, basically, like, fall.
Now through the summer?
Yeah, through the summer.
Yeah, and then the
it's fall. It's like spring, summer, right? Yeah. We're starting something else around the 50th anniversary in September.
Right.
So, sit down, read the book but in the next month, like, and prepare yourself by, I think it'll be really valuable. It'll give you the whole context, so when we zoom in on a passage, you also have the big scope of things, too, so. I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, anyway. It's going to be good. I'm looking forward to it. Ezekiel's been good, though. I've enjoyed Ezekiel. It's not a book for me that I've spent much time in, so I've enjoyed kind of reading through the passages, listening to the sermons, kind of digging in and, like, watching you kind of, dig out some nuggets and point us to some things that have been really helpful. We got a question on Ezekiel. Thank you to our faithful people who send questions in. As always, you can send your questions to the B-side email, which is bside@twasalliance.org. I am,
nailed
that's like
it.
3 weeks in a row I've got it without butchering it. So somebody, question about, from Ezekiel chapter 34, and essentially the passage is talking about the fat sheep and the lean sheep. And so the lean sheep seem to be okay, so to speak, in God's eyes, like he's, the way the passage directs it. So who then are the fat sheep, essentially, is the question. I don't know, maybe you want to read the passage and give some clarification and then dig into that question.
So it's in our passage from Sunday. Talks about the bad shepherds. He's going to come against the bad shepherds. He's going to come seek out his people, verse 11 to like 16. And then it talks about these God judging between the fat sheep and the lean sheep, and what does that mean? And we kind of skipped over it in the message. I mean, it's a long passage. You gotta gotta focus, and you can't deal with everything that's in there. There's a lot in here, but here's the verses. So thank you for asking the question, because I intentionally skipped over it for time, but now we have.
You're welcome.
Now we have.
Oh,
time.
Not me. I did ask the question.
Yes,
but you I restated someone else's.
Verse 17 says, "As for you, my flock, thus says the Lord God, behold, I judge between sheep and sheep, between rams and male goats. Is it not enough for you to feed on the good pasture that you must tread down with your feet the rest of your pasture, and to drink of clear water that you must muddy the rest of the water with your feet? And must my sheep eat what you have trodden with your feet and drink what you have muddied with your feet? Therefore, thus says the Lord God to them, I myself will judge between the fat sheep and the lean sheep. Because you push with side and shoulder and thrust at all the weak with your horns till you have scattered them abroad. I will rescue my flock. They shall no longer be a prey. And I will judge between sheep and sheep." And then it talks about David coming and stuff like that. So who are the fat sheep? I think he's really, like, the metaphor is getting pushed to its limits here. And what does this all mean? I think the fat sheep is, are the shepherds, the bad shepherds.
Hmm.
He kind of switches the analogy. First, they're bad shepherds. He's going to remove them because the shepherds are also sheep as well. They're part of this flock. And so God's going to come and judge between the fat sheep are those who harm, abuse. They're like shouldering and kind of ramming the other sheep. They're feeding on the other sheep maybe, or what. So the
you're giving fat sheep a bad name.
Right? Yeah, I mean,
because if you had to choose, I mean,
it's who you'd eat.
You'd eat the fat sheep, right?
Yeah, I don't think that's the. Yeah.
Anyway.
So I think the fat sheep are the bad leaders of the people.
Right. Getting fat off the spoils of everyone else, unfairly.
Yeah, I think that's the way to read it, is that at first he calls them shepherds, and then he removes them, and then he's, even of among the flock, he removes them from the role, but then they're still sheep. He, of the flock, he's judging the flock. He's going to be the one now in authority, judging between the fat ones who are the, in the image, they're like the abusive, sinful, whatever, wicked. And the lean sheep are sort of the ones that are being abused, led astray,
right,
not being fed. So he's going to judge. And
so he's differentiating them in the context of from within the flock. So he's not saying that the lean are, if you're lean, you're in, if you're fat, you're out.
Well,
in a sense, it's like, it's much more so, of like, this is the flock. Here's how the judgment's going to fall. So mercy may go in greater abundance to the lean, and judgment in greater abundance to the fat.
So if the sheep are the house of Israel, the people of Israel, I think what's happening is he is going to pull out those who are the abusive, sinful, evil, whatever, fat sheep, the ones that are totally breaking covenant and not going in the way of the Lord. And so I think what we're seeing here is one of many places where, but it kind of develops where not is all Israel is Israel, that even among Israel there's a elect remnant, that there's the faithful sheep that God will bring through, and then there's those who abuse and hurt and destroy and break covenant who will, God will come against them. So I think first he removes them as shepherds. They're still fat sheep. They're fat because they're abusive. That's the image. And he is going to judge, and he's going to decide. And not all Israel will be preserved and right, and be the true people of God. So I think, and God's going to be the one that decides and brings out justice, so that those who have abused and opposed will be held accountable. So I think that's what the fat sheep, was that all the questions about that?
Yeah. The difference between them, and are both part of God's flock, or only the lean sheep in?
I think, so it says, as for you, my flock, I'm going to judge between sheep and sheep. So in a sense, they're all part of Israel. But I think what you see by the end of the passage is he's pulling some out. Hmm. And not all Israel is Israel. There's a remnant, a faithful remnant that will be preserved and saved and brought through. But those that have been abusive are going to come under God's authority in, and be removed from the flock. You can push the image only so far, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's the hard thing sometimes, is when we want to kind of find clear meaning and kind of all-encompassing meaning through an illustration or an image. Sometimes it's kind of like, at certain points,
It breaks down.
The
main idea, though, is instead of the bad shepherds, who are, they're the ones that are judging.
Right.
They're the ones in authority. They're the ones, and they're acting with injustice. But Yahweh's going to come, remove the bad shepherds. He himself is going to be the king in authority over them, and he will judge fairly. Yeah. And things will be made right again. And those who have opposed and oppressed the innocent, they will be held accountable, and God will, I think, remove them from the flock. But it's not as clear as I'd like it to be.
Yeah. All right.
Hopefully that helped.
Hopefully that's helpful. If it wasn't, ask again, and we'll try to get further clarification. Another question we had coming in was, I'm assuming this is from someone who's just been in their devotional reading.
I think this is like a community group was discussing community, based on last week's message.
Right. That's right. Yeah. Out of 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, had a question that came up out of it. And I'll just read the text and then I'll ask you the question. It says, starting in verse 9 of 2 Thessalonians 2, the coming of the lawless one is by the activity of Satan, with all power and false signs and wonders, and with all wicked deception for those who are perishing, because they refuse to love the truth and so be saved. Therefore, God sends them a strong delusion, so that they may believe what is false, in order that all may be condemned who did not believe the truth but had pleasure in unrighteousness. So the question, I think, big picture question, is kind of about election. But at the end of the day, the question that this group came up with was, what does it mean that God sends this delusion that's referenced in verse 10? 11. Is that fair? Like, Because essentially the text, if we're reading it correctly, is saying people rejected God, so God kind of deluded them to believe things that were false, in order, it says in verse 12, that they may be condemned.
Yeah.
So essentially what it's saying is that God tricked them to believe what's false, and they'll be condemned for it. And the question that came out of this text is this fair?
Okay, 2 Thessalonians, the problem in the church, let's read it in context, the problem in the church is that there's a group of people that the church has come to believe or has been taught or been told the day the Lord's come, and you missed it, or something like that. And Paul says, no, there's some things that need to happen first before the day of the Lord comes. And he talks about this man of lawlessness is going to come, and the restrainer, and talks about these things, and it's actually a tricky passage. One that's, we were reading, I looked up, I mentioned this to you, St. Augustine on this passage says, what was the quote?
I
can't remember how he put it, but in the City of God, Augustine referencing this passage says,
I'm not entirely sure what he's trying to get at.
He basically says, I have no idea what he's saying.
That was good.
But, like, oh.
I'm like, was that F.F. Bruce? He's like, no, Augustine. I was like, huh, that frees us up to be wrong from time to time and not know the answer.
Okay, but, so there's this all this activity that's going to come before the day of the Lord. And it says, coming of the lawless one is by the activity of Satan with all power and false signs and wonders and with all wicked deception for those who are perishing. This is really key, I think, because they refuse to love the truth and so be saved. Therefore, God sends them a strong delusion. They
so one refuse, thing precipitated.
Yeah, so it's a causal statement. One thing leads to another. You can't read verse 11, therefore God sends them a strong delusion, without looking at verse 10.
Because what does the therefore mean? What is the therefore?
What is the therefore?
Therefore. Briarcrest. What? We did learn something.
because they refused, those who are perishing, they refuse to love the truth and so be saved. These people have rejected the truth. Therefore, those who have hardened themselves against the truth, God sends a strong delusion. So, in context, there are people who have rejected God, rejected the truth. They have loved the false and rejected the truth, and God has then sent this strong delusion. They are hardened further in their rejection. Hmm. So, if you read it so what it isn't saying is there's these people, they really wanted to believe God, they wanted to believe the gospel, they wanted to follow Jesus, but God tricked them.
Right.
And it's, how is this fair? These are the people described here. Refuse to love the truth. They refuse salvation. They're going their own way. They're determined in their rebellion. God hardens them further. And they end up being condemned for this rejection. So sometimes we go, what's God doing? But there isn't like this group of innocent people that just so desperately want to obey and love God, but God's tricking them. Never happens. We are all, by default, by nature and by choice, we are sinners. We deserve punishment. We deserve judgment. Anything we receive that is grace from God, I mean, it's pure grace. Like, if we receive anything other than the punishment we deserve, it's grace from God. So
I guess the follow-up,
yeah.
The follow-up question would go, okay, so fair, so in a sense it's deserved. So then, if everything that God does is for his glory, the follow-up question is, how does something like this then glorify God?
I think a better place to go is Romans 9, when Paul talks about God's choice, God's sovereign choice. We went through this in our series last year, but because I think it's the question that gets raised here, right? Talking about he chooses Jacob and not Esau, and God's election of Jacob and Esau. And Romans 9:14, what shall we say then? Is there injustice on God's part? So it's the very question that we kind of got.
Yeah.
How is this fair? That God chose one and passed over the other?
Is there injustice? Paul says, by no means. For he says to Moses, I will have mercy on whom I have mercy, and I will have compassion on whom I have compassion. So then it depends not on human will or exertion, but on God who has mercy. So we're following our desires. We're going our own way. God has every right to show mercy to the ones he wants to and to pass over the ones he doesn't. He has that. He is God. He has that right. He is free to do that. I think we love our freedom, but most people don't like God's freedom. It right. bugs us. A good question to ask is, who's more free, us or God? Hmm. In a lot of people's minds, we deserve complete freedom, but God does not deserve to be free.
God's got to fit in a box.
He's got to submit himself to our freedom.
Yeah.
So he can only act in a way that doesn't hurt our freedom at all. We don't let God be free. Is God free? Yes, God is. I'd say God is more free than we are. God can do what fits his purposes and what he desires. So he shows mercy to whom he desires, shows compassion on whom he shows compassion. He goes on, verse 17, for the scripture says to Pharaoh, for this very purpose I have raised you up, that I might show my power in you, and that my name might be proclaimed in all the earth. So then he has mercy on whomever he wills, and he hardens whomever he wills. So then he looks at the other side, raising up Pharaoh in order to judge, in order to display his glory and power and might in destroying Egypt, so that all the world would know that Yahweh is the true and only God. And he has that right to harden whomever he wills. So then the question that they ask then is, you know, is this fair, and how does this serve God's glory and his purposes? Verse 19, Paul answers the question for us. You will say to me then, why does he still find fault? For who can resist his will? Like, how can you blame Pharaoh if God raised him up?
Yeah.
How is it? Verse 20, I don't find this satisfying. Like, it doesn't answer all our questions.
Yeah.
But it's true, right? So I think we have to submit to it. But who are you, O man, to answer back to God? Will what is molded say to its molder, why have you made me like this? Has the potter no right over the clay to make out of the same lump one vessel for honored use and one for dishonorable use? What if God, desiring to show his wrath, to make known his power, has endured with much patience vessels of wrath prepared for destruction, in order to make known the riches of his glory for vessels of mercy, which he has prepared beforehand for glory? We want God to justify himself, explain how is it fair. In the end, Paul's answer is, God is free. He has the right. He has the. He is God. He can do what he wants with the clay. He's the potter. We are the clay. The clay doesn't talk back to the potter and be like, hey, your work sucks. You're not doing it right. I should be this instead of that. He can do what he wants. And so God has complete authority to raise up some for the display of his glory in displaying his justice. Right? God is glorified in displaying his justice, and God is glorified in displaying his grace.
Yeah.
And God has every right to act this way, and we, it may not give us like the, oh, that's like wonderful, it makes, right. But okay. I think we have to submit to it.
Well, I think I'm learning, a new parent, like parenting parallels some of that stuff, where it's like, I have to think back now as a new parent with a young child that whose will is not moldable yet, because comprehend language, but like I think back to like just the rationale my parents would often use with me when I would question their decisions. I know better. That's right. That's why. That's good enough for you. Let it be. Or because I'm your dad, or I'm your mom. That's why. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you've had to use those kind of with your own kids, because their wills will butt up against ours, mm-hmm. naturally as parents. But the thing that's funny about the text you just read is like. For me, I hear that and I go, so many of the things we struggle with, in our, even in the church, that we talk about as debated issues, we don't need to get into all the different kind of debated issues about different things that people have different interpretations on. For me, a lot of that comes down to that passage, is that I feel like if we really heard that, we wouldn't fight with each other as much about what we want. As best, I may want to do this, and I may want to do that, or I feel this way, and it created me this way, or whatever, as the argument for anything, because we understand that at the end of the day, like, we're called to obey God and not question. I mean, in a sense, not question. I think he's big enough for our questions, but mm-hmm. not expect that he is going to have to justify himself to us.
Yeah, I mean, and that's kind of where Paul eventually lands in this is, we're not really in a position where we're entitled to know exactly why. Hmm. So I think big picture, the question, how is God glorified in some people, many people being judged and condemned? How is that good? How is that for his glory? If God does everything for his glory,
mm-hmm.
Well, God will display perfectly in the end, all of his divine attributes. He will display in the lives of many people. God will glorify his name by perfectly displaying that he is a God of justice, holiness, righteousness. He always does the right thing. Wrong will be punished. Things will be made right. And in others, God will perfectly display his glory in showing grace to sinners who did not deserve grace. And he showed mercy on those who, for nothing that they did themselves, he just shows them mercy and welcomes them in.
Yeah.
And God is glorified in both of those things. Now, so we have a big picture sense of why. How could sending someone to hell bring God glory? But I think it doesn't fully answer a question. I mean, I still go, like, a good question, a good follow-up is, okay, but why so many people?
Hmm.
Like, couldn't he display his glory in justice by just condemning 20 people and the rest saved? Like, why does it work out with, why this person and not that person? And we want to know all the answers. And I'm curious. I want to know, how come that many people? How come this many? How come this and that? And I want to know the detailed answer of why. Couldn't he display his wrath in, like, just one guy and then save everyone else? Why does it work out that way? And that's where I just need to go, that's his job.
Yeah.
And he is sovereign. And I'd rather have a big God who his ways, though I understand why in the big sense he does things, I don't know why the details, why it works out this way, why this, why. He's bigger than me, and I don't get it, and I'm okay with that. I'd rather have a big God who I can't explain every detail, but he's big and he's sovereign, than a little God where it's like, he's a computer program, and there's a code to have. And he's just small, and he's smaller than our troubles. I'll serve the big, wild God of Ezekiel.
Yeah.
Who's sovereign, holy, and glorious, and he's bigger than me. He is the potter. I'm the clay. I'm good with that.
Yeah.
It actually, what frightens me more than a big, holy, glorious God, sovereign God, is this picture of God where I'm the potter, he's the clay, and God does what I want.
God's a genie.
And then, you know what? He's not there for me. He's not big enough for our problems. In a world of ISIS and earthquakes and billions of people that need Jesus and, you know, worrying about my children and my grandchildren and the future of the world, I need a big God. Yeah. I need the God of the Bible who's a little bit wild, a little bit, you know, he's huge and sovereign, and he's not always explainable, but he's big enough to face our world, and he's big enough to face anything I'm going to face. And I'd rather have a big God that I can't explain than a little God who I can't really turn to when everything seems to be chaos. I can't trust it's in his hands.
Yeah, and I think the more that I think we talk about these things, the more it unearths just our need to let go. Let it go. Let it go. Anyway, in the sense of, like, mm-hmm. we got to trust it. It's okay. Now, I mean, I was thinking, like, the thing that always stands out to me when we have the conversations like this, talk about the bigness of God and the fact that we don't always get to know, we don't have a right to know everything, is the kind of, we won't find that out this side of heaven, kind of as a rationale. And the older I get, the more I start thinking, we may not find out, period. Yeah. Just because we're going to be in heaven doesn't mean God's going to go be like, all right, here's the roadmap, here's the rationale for everything I did. Like, he suddenly owes us and justifies himself.
An answer, yeah.
Yeah, so why, like, you know.
I don't think, yeah, like,
because we often think through those
people
things,
talk,
right?
We'll know in heaven.
Yeah, and I'm like, I don't think we will.
I'm going to have a thing or two I'm going to ask God when I get to heaven.
Yeah.
I'm not sure you will.
Yeah.
Sure you're entitled to know exactly
what. That's not a good idea.
Does God owe you an explanation?
That's like me being like,
who are you?
I'm going to post up Shaq. Good luck with that. Like, he's gigantic. Maybe not the greatest parallel I can make, but I'll try.
Yeah, we're not.
I think we will know things more fully. I think we will know enough. I believe that when God brings his justice and the day of the Lord comes, and I think it will make sense to everyone.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean that God will owe us an explanation on the details, but we will see. I love it when, I can't remember who said this first or where it even came from, but that God will restore, and I'm going to butcher this, okay? God will restore and fix and heal, and it'll somehow be more beautiful for having been first broken. I believe that's where the world is going, that it was beautiful and good, and it got broken by sin, and God's sovereign plan was from the beginning that there would be people that would rebel against him, and that he would display the glory of his grace through saving many people by the blood of the Lamb before the foundation of the world. He had this plan in place. And he would glorify his name through the saving of many, through the blood of the Lamb, saving these individuals whose names are written in the Lamb's Book of Life before the foundation of the world. And he has this big plan to do this. And I don't think where was I going with this? Oh, and it's going to be, and it's better this way.
Yeah, right.
That's what I'm saying. I totally got distracted.
I blanked out there, I'll be honest.
It's late in the day. Man, we ran out of coffee. But
I only had 7 cups today.
My point is that the world gets broken in order to be healed through Christ, and that God's name will be glorified. And in the end, we will go, it was better for having been broken first and healed first. And somehow God will be more glorified and we'll be more satisfied. Life will be better and more beautiful after restoration than if it had always been perfect.
Well, that's good. I mean, and I worried here that we weren't going to have enough to talk about to fill the time.
Oh, today. Man, you ask questions like that.
Yeah, good stuff. Yeah, the best, I always find, like, sometimes the best things that we talk about come up just off the top of our heads when we're just connecting dots. But the questions we got were awesome. That's okay. Not to disregard
the question. Passage was in the back of my head, but as I said that, is I'm just going to drop this bomb and then we'll Revelation 13, verse 8. It's one of those verses you just sit on and go, whoa. Okay. He's talking about those who are going to worship the beast and those who are not going to worship the beast. And all who dwell on the earth will worship it. Everyone whose name has not been written before the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb that was slain. Who worships the beast? Everyone whose name is not written in the book. What book? There's a book. Before the foundation of the world, there's a book called the book of life of the Lamb that was slain. Before Genesis 1:1, God had a book of the names of the people who would be saved by the blood of the Lamb. Then he created the world.
Yeah.
Drops mic.
That's big. Boom. All right.
He's bigger.
That's something to leave you thinking about. If you have questions, as always, as I mentioned, send them to the B-side at twosalliance.org. Or if you have, like, funny blogs you come across and want us to comment on something, if you didn't hear before, we're going to be starting Acts at Easter. So if you get a chance in the next month, read through the book of Acts in one sitting, if possible. It's a great read to get you prepared as we head into that series. You may have heard about it on Sunday if you were here. If you weren't, you have to check out information on the website, but look at the book with John Piper. He's coming to Westside Church in April, and we are going to take over as much as possible. So get your tickets. They're just $10. It's a Friday night, Saturday morning event. It's going to be outstanding as John Piper just kind of shows us his kind of keys to how he unlocks Scripture.
Yeah.
Text by text. It'll be really interesting. So get your tickets. We have a bunch. We're getting more, but lay claim to those now. You can email the office or get in touch, but... yeah, Steve, thanks for your wisdom on those things. We look forward to bringing you more wisdom next week. Same B-side time, same B-side channel. Yeah.